From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, harsh criticism for President Obama, the war in Afghanistan and Vice President Joe Biden, all in the crosshairs of the memoirs of former US Defence Secretary Robert Gates.
Decisions the president makes about sending and keeping military forces, American men and women in uniform in Afghanistan, have to do with US national security interests, not those kinds of issues.
Hero or traitor, the fate of Edward Snowden attracts growing debate over possible clemency for the NSA whistleblower. And we look at the case of the woman being kept alive on life support in Texas because she's 14 weeks pregnant.
Are they then going to perform a cesarean operation on the brain-dead body of this poor woman?
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Criticism of President Obama made by former Defense Secretary Robert Gates in his memoirs has been disputed by the White House. In his book, Gates says that President Obama can't stand Afghan President Hamid Karzai and did not fully believe the surge of U.S. forces into Afghanistan would work. Kate Fisher reports from Washington.
The claims made in a new memoir by the president's former Pentagon chief have rocked the Capitol. Robert Gates says that President Obama didn't trust General David Petraeus, who was overseeing the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and that he was skeptical his administration's Afghan strategy would succeed. But White House spokesman Jay Carney says the book paints an inaccurate picture.
The president believes thoroughly in the mission. He knows it's difficult, but he believes that our men and women in uniform, as well as those civilians in Afghanistan and others who are working on this issue, have admirably and heroically fulfilled that mission.
Thousands of residents of the South Sudanese city of Benchu are fleeing in terror ahead of an expected government push to recapture the area. Many are taking shelter in a UN base. Peace talks between the government and rebel militants have stalled. The past 3 weeks of conflict have left at least 1,000 dead and 200,000 displaced. President Obama has telephoned German Chancellor Angela Merkel and wished her a speedy recovery after she broke her pelvis in a skiing accident. It's believed to be the first time the two leaders have spoken since Mrs. Merkel called the White House to complain over America's tapping of her cell phone. Rob Flynn has details.
The news of the phone call to Chancellor Merkel was disclosed by the White House in a short written statement. The president wished the chancellor a speedy recovery following her skiing accident and invited her to visit Washington over the next few months. The White House did not disclose the chancellor's reaction to the invitation. The relationship between Washington and Berlin has been deeply frayed by the revelation of extensive U.S. electronic surveillance in Germany, including the bugging of the chancellor's cell phone. The president's call suggests the White House hopes to put all of this in the past.
Another U.S. military helicopter has crashed, this time a U.S. Navy Sea Dragon off the coast of Norfolk, Virginia, on America's East Coast. Earlier, a U.S. Air Force Pave Hawk helicopter crashed during a training mission in England, killing all four on board. American sports celebrity Dennis Rodman created a spectacle during his most recent trip to North Korea. The basketball star sang happy birthday to the country's leader in front of a crowd of 14,000, calling Kim Jong-un his very best friend. Rodman has been criticized for his visits to North Korea, but he continues to defend his actions, calling them basketball diplomacy. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. More than 100 people, including retired New York City police officers and firefighters, have been charged with collecting fraudulent disability payments. A prosecutor alleges they were fishing, playing sports, and teaching martial arts while claiming thousands of dollars a year from the government. Many claim to be suffering from mental illness related to their service during the September 11th terrorist attacks. Quinn Bowman reports from New York.
A Manhattan prosecutor alleges the scam netted hundreds of millions of U.S. dollars, all going to retired public servants who were not actually disabled. Many of those claim to be suffering from mental illness from their service during the September 11th terrorist attacks. They collected as much as $50,000 a year. Four ringleaders are accused of helping the retirees fake the mental illnesses. All pleaded not guilty. One defendant posted to the internet a photo of himself on a personal watercraft, while another operated a martial arts studio. Authorities say the investigation is ongoing.
And Indian officials are continuing to take retaliatory measures following the arrest of a U.S.-based Indian diplomat. Devani Kopra-Kadi was subject to a strip search and faces charges relating to her Indian maid. Daniel Wrenches has more.
Indian officials now say U.S. diplomats in India will no longer be subject to the usual diplomatic perks related to immunity from paying fines for traffic violations and unauthorized parking. They've also warned that a U.S. embassy club called the American Community Support Association violates diplomatic law because it's open to outsiders who can pay to join it. The arrest and strip search of the New York-based 39-year-old diplomat Devyani Kopra-Kadi, who's accused of paying her Indian maid below minimum wage and lying about it on a visa application, has generated huge public outrage in India. She faces up to 15 years in jail. Though she insists she has diplomatic immunity, U.S. federal prosecutors have been trying to work out a plea deal.
And that's the latest feature story news. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports.
The issues here are not about personalities, they're about policies. And the decisions the president makes about sending and keeping military forces, American men and women in uniform in Afghanistan, have to do with U.S. national security interests, not those kinds of issues.
White House Press Secretary Jay Carney fielding questions following the release of the memoirs of former U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates. The book sees President Obama come in for some harsh criticism, in particular saying that he didn't think Mr. Obama believed in his own strategy regarding the war in Afghanistan. For him, writes Mr. Gates, referring to the president, it's all about getting out. Well, FSN's Lorna Shaddix's been speaking to Chris Griffin, the executive director of Foreign Policy Initiative and a former defense journalist, to get his take on the book. She began by asking him what the book tells us about the Obama administration's handling of the war in Afghanistan, and in particular, the troop surge back in late 2009.
Gates has a reputation, of course, as being a team player, that he's served in almost every administration since President Nixon. But he's also a straight shooter. And in this book, that from what we've seen so far, he gives a very candid assessment of his service during an incredibly frustrating period in both the Bush and the Obama administrations. In his assessment, he describes his frustrations with how the Obama administration reached its decisions on Afghanistan, as particularly sharp criticism for some members of the National Security Staff, the White House staff that supports the president. A key point, though, is that he says that the major decisions, that the decision for the surge in 2009, were the right decisions. And the question is the conviction to carry those decisions out.
That did seem to be a bit of contradiction because, as you say, he then, if not praised the president's decisions, certainly backed them up.
When you look at the essence of those decisions, that Gates really learned two lessons, I think, in his service. One was that success in both Iraq, of course, which was the major war when he came into office, and in Afghanistan would depend upon providing security to the people in those countries. And second was that he would have to fight Washington institutions to provide our service members with the protective equipment and the support that they needed to win those wars. So whenever he looked at those decisions, and the surge came down to the same lesson that he learned in Iraq, was providing security to the Afghan people, that was a highly contentious decision. It required sending 30,000 more servicemen to the conflict. But at the end of the day, it was the right decision. It's one he stands by.
Now, you mentioned that Gates is normally a bit of a team player.
Mm-hmm.
How surprised, then, were you by this memoir? Because there is quite a bitter tone to it.
Secretary Gates was, and this memoir shows, still is, a straight shooter. That he'll provide his candid thoughts on the issues that are most important, and that's what he's done here. It's unusual often to have a president still in office come under this type of criticism from a former member of his administration, but at the end of the day, I believe that Gates is being honest about what he experienced and how he saw it.
President Obama wasn't the only figure to come in for some criticism in this memoir. President Biden as well. Robert Gates writes about him as being consistently wrong on policy issues.
When you look at the issues on which he's criticizing the vice president, and you can look at the handling of the war in Iraq, or at one point the vice president, whenever he was still in the Senate, recommending dividing the country into multiple parts. When you look at the decision to surge in Afghanistan, the vice president's strong opposition to that. The claim from Secretary Gates that Biden was wrong substantively on those important issues.
Do you think there are any points in the book that the White House might, even if it doesn't say so publicly, mm-hmm. take to heart and change its behavior accordingly?
The most important one in the coming year is going to be the president clearly stating what his expectations are for the future U.S. and NATO partnership with Afghanistan. We've seen with the growing violence in Iraq what happens whenever we walk away from this type of situation. If we aren't there for the long haul, you could see even greater violence in Afghanistan than you're seeing in Iraq today. Personality always shapes policy. And when you look at the Obama administration, I think you can see a clear shift from the Bush administration. This is something that Gates writes about, that the level of trust and close relationship that President Bush had with his senior advisors in the military, and the relative distrust between the Obama administration and top military officials.
Chris Griffin, Executive Director of Foreign Policy Initiative, speaking to FSN's Lorna Shaddick. This is FSN Reports. To the US government, he's a fugitive, wanted for espionage for divulging national secrets, but to his supporters, he's a hero, responsible for blowing the lid off the secret surveillance practices of the National Security Agency. Whichever side of the argument you fall, one thing is certain. The actions of Edward Snowden and his fate are now the stuff of fierce debate. Speaking to FSN, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham made his position clear.
To me, what Snowden did is he betrayed his country, who's at war with radical Islam. We're at war with an enemy that knows that doesn't play by any rules. So I don't see, if you granted him clemency or gave him some kind of special deal, you're basically denying we're at war.
The senator's opinion was in stark contrast to Jesselyn Radack from the Government Accountability Project, who spoke to me earlier.
Well, I certainly think Edward Snowden doesn't deserve any kind of punishment. He's been punished quite enough for starting a conversation that even the president of our United States says needs to be had. Interestingly, the ideas for amnesty and pardon and clemency are not coming from Snowden's camp. Those are ideas that have been suggested by the future deputy director of the NSA, Rick Ledgett. He suggested amnesty, and the CEO of a tech giant who suggested a pardon. And then we had editorial boards of the New York Times and the Guardian suggesting clemency and pardon. So this is Congress. This is intergovernment agencies, it's industry, it's the public. These cries for clemency or some sort of pardon are coming from all sorts of places, and I think that shows the tide has turned.
You mentioned the NSA chief in waiting. Mm-hmm. Won't he follow the opinion of the current chief, Keith Alexander, that the first priority, their primary motivation, is to protect the United States from terrorism, and part of doing that involves certain things being subjected to secrecy?
In terms of these programs actually being effective and legal, pretty much a decision by a federal court judge and the White House's own internal hand-picked review panel said that they have been ineffective and that they are likely unconstitutional. So I think that argument has been harder for the government to make. Therefore, it's kind of moved on to a new argument that, oh, if we only had this, it could have stopped 9/11. Yet another false argument. But I feel like the view of Snowden in popular culture is changing as they realize the value of his revelations and, for example, the similarities to the individuals who outed themselves yesterday for revealing COINTELPRO, which was another surveillance effort back in the 60s and 70s that was illegally spying on American groups that the government did not like.
Last week, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act Court renewed the telephone metadata collection. So does that mean it's just business as usual? What's the next legal challenge for the NSA?
I think it's business as usual for now, But we have to see what recommendations President Obama decides to accept with regard to recommendations that he halt Section 215 entirely. We'll have to see what he does with that. And we'll also have to see how, when the Leon ruling and the other ruling by Pauley, when they're appealed, how those decisions turn out, because I think ultimately those cases are fast-tracked for the Supreme Court, and we'll have a better idea, you know, certainly if the Supreme Court says you can't do it, then a FISA court ruling is not going to preempt that. So I think that's what we have to look forward to.
Jesselyn Radak from the Government Accountability Project. Now, when does life begin and when does it end? The ethics of birth and death have collided in the case of a pregnant, brain-dead woman in Texas. Marlies Munoz collapsed on her kitchen floor in November from what appeared to be a blood clot in her lungs. But the hospital has refused to honour her wish that her life support be switched off because she's 14 weeks pregnant. Texas is one of more than two dozen states that prohibit medics from cutting off life support to a pregnant patient. Kate Fisher asked Terry O'Neill, president of the National Organization for Women, to explain the situation.
What's happening is these hospital administrators are holding the body of a brain-dead woman for the purpose of incubating a fetus. They made this decision at 14 weeks gestation, and they have decided to hold this this brain-dead woman's body to incubate the fetus, but we don't know beyond that what they intend to do once the fetus reaches a gestational level of 26 weeks, which is about the time that you could, as they think that a fetus could survive outside the womb. So it's... I have to say, I think that in this case, and the hospital administrator's actions are clearly against the wishes of the woman herself before she died, clearly against the wishes of her family, and I think it's fair to characterize these administrators' actions as barbaric. I mean, in one of the most heart-wrenching statements, her father told a reporter, Marlies Munoz's father told a reporter that he can hardly bear to go and hold his daughter's hand because she feels like a mannequin. This is a brain-dead woman, and the hospital administrators, in service to an ideological zeal around abortion rights, this hospital is forcing this family to go through a bizarre and gruesome experience. It's just hideous.
Why do you think the doctors are refusing to honor the wishes of this woman and her family?
I think it is pure ideology. I think the doctors, the hospital administrators have made the decision that Texas law, which states that a hospital can keep a woman in a coma, right? On life support in order to incubate a fetus, that law also applies to a brain-dead body. And it's simply truly in service of an ideological, rigid opposition to women controlling their own fertility. So the idea is, well, the fetus is a living entity that has an existence separate from the woman in whom the fetus is growing. And once you've gone there, once you've said that the fetus is separate from the woman, then you can really treat the woman as a thing to incubate the fetus and elevate the humanity of the fetus over the actual humanity of the woman, her toddler son, her grieving husband, her grief-stricken parents. All of those people, all those actual humans, are shoved aside in service of this ideological devotion to a fetus.
The hospital itself maintains it's following the law. What do you say to that?
I don't think it is. There are some legal experts that have said that the hospital is, in fact, misinterpreting the law, and I believe it is. But I think the doctors have their highest duty is to first do no harm. And hospital administrators should do that as well. They are devastating actual human beings for no reason. And let's think, what is it they're going to do at a gestational period of 26 or 27 weeks. Are they then going to perform a cesarean operation on the brain-dead body of this poor woman? And then what will they do when they've performed a cesarean? This is utterly gruesome, as I say, and bizarre, and there seems to be no plan, just a sort of slavish devotion to an idea about fetuses. It's ridiculous.
Terry O'Neill, president of the National Organization for Women. This is FSN Reports. In December, a 39-year-old female diplomat from India, who's based in New York, was arrested and then strip-searched. Devyani Kobragadi is accused of paying her Indian maid below minimum wage and then lying about the detail in a visa document. FSN's Daniel Renches discussed the details with Nick Harper in New York and began by asking him the latest reaction from India.
Well, there's been a number of things. They've had quite a lot of comments, been very, very vocal about this case in the Indian press, but they've also carried out a number of physical measures. In December, they removed the security barriers from outside the US embassy in Delhi, and they also snubbed a delegation that had come over from the US to visit. And in just the last 24 hours or so, we've heard again from the Indian government. They have now ordered the US embassy in Delhi to stop what they're calling commercial activities. So they're saying that the embassy must shut down a club that it has on its grounds, a club that has a tennis court, a pool and a restaurant. And they're saying that at this stage, the US is going against the rules of the Geneva Convention by allowing outsiders onto the premises, people who are neither US citizens or Indian nationals. And they've also said that all US embassy cars will now be penalised for any traffic offences, something that isn't normally the case for diplomatic vehicles. And throughout, they've said that the US has humiliated Ms. Kobragadi, something that they are very, very unhappy about.
And do you think that this is a sort of diplomatic spat that essentially is being played out in traffic fines? Or is there something, do you think, that's a little deeper about, I don't know, the cultural differences between India and the United States? And has the United States been insensitive to this?
Well, I think that's it. I think it comes down to the cultural differences. We have to remember that normally the US and India enjoy a very good working relationship. But it seems that they are unhappy with the way that Ms. Kobragadi was treated when she was arrested. Now, she was handcuffed and strip searched. The US marshals in charge of this arrest say that that is usual procedure. Nothing happened to her that wouldn't happen to anyone else who was being arrested. But as far as the Indian government are concerned, they're saying that this is a terrible way to treat one of their diplomats, and especially a female as well. They're saying that she was humiliated by this process. But of course, the US are saying this is what would normally have to happen. But you have to wonder perhaps whether the US government should have perhaps gone along different lines, considering that she is a diplomat who works here in New York.
I guess the Indian officials, diplomats and some of the public also remember in 2010 when the Indian ambassador, Meera Shankar, was patted down at a US airport. And then several weeks after that, a Sikh diplomat was asked to remove his turban before then receiving the diplomatic wave through. So I guess we can see the broader context here. But in this specific case, where does this case go from here? Can the US State Department sort of take over the lead because they've expressed regret about what happened? Or is this something that will continue to be just simply a law enforcement matter?
Well, yes, the US State Department have said that they regret this. It seems to have been a case that they had to play catch up on initially, not thinking that the Indian government would react in quite the way they did. There is, I suppose, in some respects, a possible route out of this. Ms. Kobragadi is currently applying for diplomatic immunity. She currently has consular immunity, which means that she's free from any charges for crimes relating to her diplomatic status, but she can be charged for this type of offence. Now, if she were to gain full diplomatic immunity, something that the US is reviewing at this stage, that could potentially be a way to free her from those charges without too much embarrassment. But at this stage, she's due to appear in court on the 13th of January. Her lawyers are asking for more time to work work on the case. The prosecution are against this. It'll be very interesting to see exactly how this plays out, though, over the next few days and weeks.
Daniel Renches with FSN's Nick Harper. All it takes is an identification card. In the US state of Colorado, anyone over the age of 21 can walk into a pot shop and purchase marijuana if they show a valid ID. Denver correspondent Mary McCarthy takes us inside the nation's first legal marijuana market.
Eighth of blueberry indica, THC-infused lotion and salve.
There's a steady stream of customers at 3D Discreet Dispensary in Denver.
This is people being able to celebrate the choices they want to make as adults, and we're ending a failed policy of prohibition.
Betty Aldworth is one of the many Colorado marijuana activists who led the push for the drug to be regulated in a way similar to alcohol. She now serves as the deputy director of the National Cannabis Industry Association.
What we've done here is we've provided in a store, very similar to a store where one can go pick up a six-pack, marijuana for purchase for adults 21 and over.
Colorado's pot shops are attracting large numbers of customers from other states. Marijuana is still banned in every other state besides Washington, where it's legal to use and possess, but where retail shops still have not opened.
Colorado is now fully open for business for tourists who want to come and witness for themselves that this is real. You can come in, show your ID the same way you do for alcohol, and purchase marijuana, and as long as you can behave yourself and act responsibly, then Colorado is welcoming to you, unlike any other state in the United States or any other country in the world, really.
Matt Brown runs a Denver-based marijuana tourism agency called My 420 Tours.
We have gotten interest from all across the United States, certainly, but every continent except Antarctica.
Before recreational pot sales became legal in Colorado on New Year's Day, the state already had a booming medical marijuana industry. Tony Fox, who runs 3D Discreet Dispensary, warns all of her customers that the cannabis she's selling them is medical grade.
It's very potent. Our recommended dosage for our cannabis is one or two inhalations, and then we ask that they put it out.
Even if the drug is legal in Colorado, it's still prohibited under U.S. federal law, which means that companies can fire employees who fail drug tests. Marijuana reform attorney Jessica Peck thinks that with a majority of Americans now supporting legalization, that won't be much of an issue.
And as we become more acclimated to marijuana for recreational purposes, we're going to see less employers drug testing. According to university researchers this year, up to 1 in 4 Coloradans that are adults will be using marijuana in the next year.
Many Coloradans have expressed concern about children and teenagers getting their hands on the edible and drinkable forms of the drug. Law requires the packaging to be childproof, labeled with a marijuana leaf. But some say that's not enough. Joel Warner covers Colorado's marijuana industry for Slate.com.
Marijuana leaf isn't going to, they're going to associate that with something bad. It's going to look like a fun, pretty green leaf. So it needs something else. So in other words, how do you come up with a new kind of warning label, new Mr. Yuck?
In some ways, it's still the Wild West out here in Colorado, with many questions remaining about what this new retail marijuana market will look like. In Denver, I'm Mary McCarthy.
And that's the Wednesday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of the program. Email us, reports@featurestory.com. You can also follow us on Twitter. We're there, @FeatureStory. Coming up on Thursday, the push to control US purchase of so-called conflict minerals. That's Thursday. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Kate Fisher and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.